Welcome to Real Time Real Talk, a Dexcom podcast dedicated to pharmacists and other healthcare professionals on the front lines helping people thrive who live with diabetes.
And that's the beauty of CGM is there's no mystery, right? So you can find out. You wouldn't have to do 12 finger sticks over the course of the afternoon.
Dexcom is the leading developer of real-time continuous glucose monitoring.
For healthcare providers, understand CGM is a game changer. It's critically important. You're empowering people to figure out what works. Nobody chooses to be unwell. And give people a tool that will help them figure out strategies with you to stay well, to get better, or to stay healthy, avoid problems. That's a win-win-win for situations.
For more information on all Dexcom technologies, please visit Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Real Time Real Talk. I'm Cher Pastore, the host. And in today's episode, we are recording from ADA, the American Diabetes Association conference held here in San Diego. In this episode, we will be discussing real stories and expert tips for seamless glucose monitoring. My guest today is Dr. Nicholas Argento. Dr. Argento is an endocrinologist at the Maryland Endocrine and Diabetes Center in Columbia, Maryland. He is an expert in diabetes technology and has lived with type 1 diabetes for over 40 years. Welcome, Dr. Argento.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me. Actually, it's now 55 years, so I made my 50th anniversary, and I'm still well and intact. And it's only because I've had access to tools that have helped me thrive and survive. And as somebody that's at both ends of the stethoscope, CGM has been a game changer for me personally, but it's also for my patients as well. So I'm seeing so much success, I'm almost spoiled by it.
Yeah, 55 years, wow. So do you count your anniversaries in increments of 10? So 60 is the next big one?
Each year, okay. Yeah, I silently mark it. I did actually have a more of a kind of formal celebration at 50 years because that did seem like quite a landmark.
Monumental.
Yes.
Nice.
And got a survivor medal for that from DeJocelyn and from the Diabetes Center. And I actually have them proudly on my desk, sort of hanging there.
Oh my gosh.
Reminds me of where we started, how far things have come, and that I'm still here.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Take nothing for granted, but take care of yourself, right? It's work, but it works.
Yes. Tell us all about your journey. Walk us through your journey, how you manage things when you were first diagnosed, which I'm sure is very different than how it currently is. So you know advances in technology and how has it helped you?
So when I was diagnosed in August of 1968, I was 8 years old, and I was admitted to the hospital, and they actually just drew one blood test. They did oral hydration and then tried to teach my mother and I, mostly my mother, how to eat a, quote, diabetic diet and to do urine testing, which was the only way to check blood glucose, which is almost useless, and also to inject insulin. So there were, you know, different types of insulin. At that time, glass syringes were in wide circulation. I fortunately did not need a glass syringe. I started with disposable syringes.
Was MPH around then?
Yes. So that was beef, pork, NPH. And I like to refer to NPH as standing for not particularly helpful. It's really a kind of a primitive insulin, at least for somebody with type 1, and regular insulin. And I was starting on one shot a day and eventually moved to two shots a day. But what was happening at that time is that you were driving down a twisty mountain road with your eyes closed. You just could not see what you were trying to regulate. So it was impossible to maintain good control in any meaningful sense. And it was very frustrating, actually, because if you tried to sort of be good and be real careful with your diet, you'd end up getting hypoglycemic. I had dozens and dozens of severe low blood sugar reactions when I would try and be a good diabetic. And the other part of me would then say, well, this isn't possible. I can't live this way. So blood glucoses would be quite high then. That's not the choice today. That wasn't always the choice then, but that's not the choice today. You have the tools so you can see what you're doing, you learn from your experience. You have CGM is a behavior modification device with a safety net. Both parts of that are essential. It would not have been possible to have CGM develop unless we first had finger sticks. So finger stick blood sugars, which I started doing in about 1980, 81, at that time were a complete game changer because I could finally see what I was trying to regulate and have some ability to see the effects of my actions or inactions, change my dose of insulin. So that was a huge step forward. If you think through the history of diabetes, the discovery of insulin was of paramount importance. The second most important thing was finger sticks that are widespread available. Third most important is CGM, because then you've got your GPS for your glucose.
Perfect. And you've been through the whole evolution. Well, not the whole thing. We don't know what's coming next, but evolution to date. So what system are you currently using?
So I'm currently using the Dexcom G6, and because I have a Tandem Control IQ insulin pump. And so that's the fourth revolution. Insulin number one, finger sticks number two, CGM number three. Now, CGM integrating with an automated insulin delivery device is the newest and life-changing revolution in diabetes care, because basically you're transferring some of the work of in brain space and emotional energy of trying to manage your glucose to a device that helps you get back, sort of gently brings you back to where you should be, or up to where you should be, or down to where you should be.
So tell people how, if they're not familiar with Control IQ, a little bit about how the system works and some things you can control on it if someone were to go on it.
So automated insulin delivery, just fundamentally, is you're taking an insulin pump, which initially was a fancy syringe. I started an insulin pump in 1981. It was really a fancy syringe. It was difficult to use. But they became gradually more sophisticated and became diabetes management devices, but they were still open loop, meaning there was no feedback from the glucose. I had to provide the feedback. So the feedback loop was through CGM to my brain, to my fingers, to change the control of the pump. So now you can't do that at night. What AID does, or automated insulin delivery, is it takes me out of the loop. I don't have to be there continuously. So particularly at night, when I'd prefer to sleep than think about my diabetes, my insulin pump is looking at my Dexcom readings, constantly going up and down on the glucose to allow me to wake up in the morning with a good glucose level with minimal risk of low blood sugar reactions. So that is the biggest change with AID systems.
Okay.
Is overnight, when the patient is sleeping, hopefully, that they wake up with a good blood glucose and do it safely.
Yes. I used to be in practice as a certified diabetes educator, and I remember some of my patients or loved ones of people who have diabetes saying this was like the first time they ever slept through the night, or have slept through the night in a long, long time.
That comment about sleep disturbance is a huge stressor within the diabetes community. So the people who perhaps are most affected by this are the parents of young children. I really feel for them, because you're frightened at night. You're afraid your child's not going to wake up. How can you sleep soundly with that in your mind? And so I've had patients tell me, I mostly see adults, but occasionally a teenager will sneak in because a parent or somebody knew me just said, please, could you see this person? And I remember a parent telling me that she'd basically never, since the child had been diagnosed, had not had one night where she did not wake up at least twice to have to attend to her daughter's blood glucose. And the daughter had many, many severe low blood sugar reactions, really frightening. So eliminating that with a CGM, or at least being able to glance and say, she's okay, I can go back to sleep, is valuable. Now, in my situation, you know, I'm married. My wife rarely has to awaken now because of some low sugar reaction event. She occasionally nudges me, hey, you know, you're beeping. Instead of awakening because I'm having a seizure and having to call 911, she's getting early warning, like, hey, Nick, you know, do you need something? Your pump's making noise. So we both sleep better.
Good. So tell us about some, like, particular features that you like, either on the G6 or the pump, like the urgent low soon, maybe some like specific features that you have felt have definitely helped you.
So one thing I should step back and say this, that if I had a choice between an insulin pump and a continuous glucose monitor, first I wouldn't like the choice. I'd try an Outfox, who's making me make that choice. But I would clearly choose the continuous glucose monitor because that has provided the protection from hypoglycemia and allowed me to figure out what I can eat and not eat and how I can modify what I do effectively. So that information is invaluable. If I had a choice, that should, I think, be first and foremost because it provides something that finger sticks can just not provide. Now, linking the two together, what I like about the G6 is it's factory calibrated. So I calculated that I had probably done about 60,000 finger sticks in my lifetime. Until I started CGM, then I went from having done 8 or 10 a day to initially probably 3, and now I do 1 or 2 a month. I have my fingerprints back, right? So eliminating finger sticks. Yes, they
okay.
do, yes. So eliminating the need for finger sticks because they're painful. The other issue with finger sticks is that, you know, your fingers ooze. And so I'm working in a,
right.
you know, I'm in the office, and if I had done a finger stick, then I'm going into a room, I'm typing on the computer, I'm trying to write prescriptions.
Right.
Fingers ooze. I mean, nobody wants blood in the, you
Sounds
know.
Unsanitary.
It's not sanitary. It's also embarrassing, and it's tough on your dry cleaning as well. So, you know, nobody wants to do finger sticks unless they have to. So to be able to plug something in that hurts for about a microsecond and then have all of that information and knowing that I'm going to be safe and feel better because I'll be able to tell at a glance what where my blood sugar is, that's what CGM gives me. The other thing it gives me is this love about the alerts and alarms is I've customized these alerts and alarms, which can be overwhelming if you don't set them properly, to tell me in a timely way, you need to consider taking action. That's what an alert should mean. And so this morning, my blood glucose, I was sitting in a meeting and I had overdosed for my breakfast, even, you know, under the best circumstances, this happens. And I could drink some juice because I saw I was 80 and I said, okay, I need to do something about this. I never got hypoglycemic because I was able to intervene. So I had a predictive alert that said, you've reached 80, Control IQ thinks you need to do something. And so my pump was telling me, you should consider taking action, which I did, and I resolved it and felt fine. So I averted a disruptive, potentially dangerous and unpleasant event. And so that,
which could still happen, right, if someone wasn't on tandem control, like
right.
if they had the G6 with the urgent low soon
right.
and that happened, they could still
right.
theoretically avert
that
it.
Alert, if I didn't have the pump telling me that, I would have set the CGM. So to avoid stereo alarms for me, I actually have shut most of the mobile app alerts off because I get them from the pump.
Okay.
But if I was off my pump, I could get an alert that I'm going to be low within 20 minutes, dangerously so.
Okay.
And I would need to do something about that immediately. I usually set it for 70 because if I'm getting less than 70, that's too low, but it's not dangerous. That feature, being able to customize the alerts, I think is invaluable. The G7 will now allow people to delay the onset of a high because highs are different. Lows, you need to know in the moment, you need to do something about this. These are potentially dangerous. They're potentially life-threatening. I've lost multiple patients to severe hypoglycemia. I've been on the brink of death myself from severe hypoglycemic reaction. So you should never ignore hypoglycemia. But hyperglycemia is also a problem. And so, but, you know, if you just go above briefly, you don't need to be disturbed by that. Go ahead, live your life. But if I'm going way above my goal, maybe I forgot my dose, maybe what I ate, it was unpredictable, maybe my pump site is not working well, there could be any number of possibilities. So I get a signal when I can consider taking action. Okay, I'm high. Do I need more insulin? Do I need to correct my system? Do I need to go take a walk and maybe lower the blood glucose, you know, that way? So there's a lot of behavioral strategies that are available, but I get to choose when I'm going to be alerted, at what level, and that gives me a chance then to take some action to correct it. And that's important for long-term control to stay healthy. It's also important today. You will feel better today if you avoid severe post-meal high blood sugars.
Right, up and down.
Yes, so the reinforcement is not just your average blood glucose goes down and so you're less likely to develop eye, kidney, nerve, heart problems. That's great, we want that. But I also want to feel well today.
Right.
And that's the promise, and it delivers on CGM, where you find out ways to minimize both the lows and the highs.
Right.
And act on them when your best intended plans didn't work.
Right, so let's talk about some strategies that you do have for managing either postprandial hyperglycemia or just food in general, but probably postprandial hyper is the most significant. And, you know, maybe we can do it in such a way that if there are some HCPs out there that aren't familiar with some of these tips or techniques, and what would they do? How could we help them learn some strategies?
So there's a lot of emphasis on time in range or time in the target range. For people who aren't pregnant, we want to be between 70 and 180 most of the time. 70%, but that's most of the time. That makes sense. We want to minimize to less than an hour a day, 4%, less than 70. Okay, so if you're outside of that range, there's only two possibilities, right? You're either getting too much hypoglycemia, and we can talk about that separately, or you're going over those targets. And the driver for time above range, that is above 180, particularly above 250, is eating. So in an ideal situation, somebody with diabetes would never eat and never move, right? And so it'd be really easy to control their blood glucose in that circumstance, but obviously that's not feasible or desirable for that matter. So looking for patterns. So for the time above range, I think there's a couple of simple things, the way to think about this, talking about people who are on insulin now, not basal insulin, but on meals, meal insulin and some kind of background insulin. Okay, so what do you do? So if you're going up after your meal, then that means that the amount of insulin that was taken for that meal didn't link up, right? So it could be that the person needs to have more insulin for that particular meal. So that's one possibility. But there's other things you can do. So you could take the insulin a bit before the meal. So 15 or 20 minutes, give that insulin a head start, because there's a race between the meal insulin and the food. And the food generally starts out with a head start because we're injecting subcutaneously. It takes some time for that to take effect. So you could move it out a bit further, 15, 20 minutes. You can only do that safely if you're sure on the timing of the meal. So you can't do that in restaurants or if you're driving or the timing of food is outside of control. So pre-dosing, that's number one. Increasing the amount of insulin is number two, but, you know, per carbohydrate, for example. But the third most important or third sort of factor here is for people to limit the amount of carbohydrate they're eating. Not eliminate, limit, not eliminate carbohydrates. So if somebody sees, I see that my glucose is really high after a particular type of a meal, then that means I need either, maybe I shouldn't eat that food, or maybe I should eat less of that food when I do eat it, the amount. Maybe I should eat that food less often because it's going to be difficult. Maybe I should avoid it entirely. Maybe I just need to eat it more toward the end of the meal. So that's a way to lower this post-meal peak. So a lot of variables there, but the key one is limiting the amount of carbohydrates. I like to, you know, use analogies and sort of trying to make people understand it. So, you know, I had said something, I was driving down the road with my eyes closed without finger sticks, with no be able to check. Okay, so now we're back in this car and I'm driving down this twisty mountain road. How do I stay on the road and not end up in a ditch? So I could get super grip racing gloves and the best tires in the world and have a car that really, you know, can handle turns really well. Or I could just drive slower. Eating less carbohydrate is driving slower. It's just easier to stay on the road. So a good definition of that for most people is if you're between 1 and 200 grams of carbohydrate a day, that's actually less than the average American, but it's not a keto diet. So 1 to 200 is reasonable. Limiting the carbohydrate per meal to 30 to 60 per meal is actually a reasonable target for most people that gets you in that zone.
I mean, interestingly, even people without diabetes probably should be adhering to those principles as well. But it's hard. You know, some people don't want to change what they eat, and so you got to do the best you can, I guess.
Right. Well, there are other things. So limiting carbohydrate, the timing of insulin ahead of time, increasing the amount of insulin. The other sort of easy factor there is exercise after meal. So normally that's actually somewhat challenging, but you can then use it to your advantage. So if I eat a meal that's, you know, maybe starchier, it's a spiky food. One thing I can do is after I eat that, I see my sugars going up, or I know from experience it's likely to go take a walk half an hour. Yep. It'll slow down the food. It'll speed up the insulin. I won't get as much of a spike. So those are relatively simple interventions that you can use. But I think what's really important with this is empower patients to figure out what works and what doesn't work from their menu of foods that they eat, because it's probably relatively limited.
And well, hopefully the CGM, I think, could also empower the patient to be a little bit more invested in kind of the management of it. So maybe before CGM, they could have felt like they didn't have the control. And so I think in a way, if they have like perceived control, then they might make different choices too.
Right. That's a huge difference here is with CGM. How did they tell whether they were in control or not? So if it's somebody with type 1 diabetes or a multiple daily injections type 2, they would base it probably on a hemoglobin A1C, which is a 3-month imperfect test that's far removed from your actions and not very good to start with. Okay, so that's one thing. But they also, in the real time, they were mostly probably checking pre-meal blood glucoses, and you didn't see what happened in between. So if my blood glucose was 20 points higher before dinner than I really wanted it to be, did that mean that I was way up for hours and hours, or had I just sort of, you know, gone up a little bit and maybe I drifted up? Those two circumstances you can't tell because you only have one point in time. So with CGM, there's no hiding because you see the effects of your food from that. Now, somebody might say, well, gee, that sounds burdensome. The burden is having diabetes. The tool is so I can see in real time how I'm going to respond and likely to respond to different foods and make better food choices. So one patient told me, and I feel this way, is Dexcom helps me make better choices. And I think that's the best summary of how this empowers people to see the effects of their food choices and their action and their adherence to their medicines, perhaps, the effects of it, not 3 months later, but right now.
Right.
The other thing I think is important with this is that people feel better oftentimes when they don't get glucoses that go to 280 or 300 after a
right.
meal. If that happens to me, I don't feel well. I want to go take a nap.
Right.
And I didn't realize how much impact that was having on me until I had CGM. And I could say, oh, that's why I feel that way after lunch if I eat a really big meal. So maybe I won't eat a big meal. I'll have a smaller meal so I can get through my day and feel better. So
right.
you can live longer in the long term, but you feel better today, and that's what you want to empower your patients to do. Take the bull by the horns.
Yes.
And
tell us about how they could maybe do that with exercise, because I know that exercise is particularly challenging in type 1 diabetes in particular. So let's just focus on type 1 with exercise on MDI or AID. What are some strategies people can use, or the HCPs could help their patients to use to manage exercise?
Okay, well, good. So exercise is important because it's better for your health, but it doesn't improve diabetes control for type 1s. It actually makes it more challenging. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. It means you need to understand that this is a challenge. And what are the challenges? So the thing that most people will notice is that low sugar coming while they're exercising. And that can be very frustrating because then you can't complete your workout. You might have to stop and ingest some fruit juice. So, and if somebody's worried about their weight and they're trying to exercise and burn up a certain number of calories, if they have to drink 3 juice boxes, I don't think they're probably going to come out ahead on that math. So that can be frustrating. So that's the challenge. So how do we deal with that? So some recommendations for patients generally is reduce the number of moving parts when you're exercising. So what are the moving parts? It would be food trying to get in, that is digest, and also insulin on board. So how much insulin beyond your background basal insulin is still on board? If you have a lot of insulin on board and food trying to get in, and then you exercise, you speed up the insulin, you slow down the food, you've got a high chance you're going to get low sugar reaction during that time. So reduce the number of moving parts. And for most people, the best way to do that is try and exercise before eating, not after. That's number one.
Wait, so if they don't eat, how are they not going to go low?
Because you don't have food waiting to get, you reduce the number of moving parts, right? Moving parts are food trying to get in and insulin on board, right? How much insulin's in play.
So if they don't eat, they don't have to bolus, and they just have the baseline.
So if somebody runs for their exercise and they do it before breakfast, they are less likely to get hypoglycemia during that time, or if they need to treat that hypoglycemia, it's going to be easier to treat because there's less insulin on board. So reduce the number of moving parts. That's the key. So exercising before. Now, that's not practical for everybody. Okay, so say, well, you know, I can't do that because I got to get home. I'm running around with my kids and I'm going to do this in my home gym or go to the gym or whatever after dinner. Okay, let's think 2 scenarios. So if I had a whole bunch of corn chips and rice and a bunch of other starchy things and took my usual amounts of insulin and then tried to exercise, it's not going to work. A lot of moving parts. Food's trying to get in, a lot of starch, carbohydrate, and I've got a lot of insulin to handle that. So if I don't take any insulin, I'm probably going to go way up, and then I'm not going to feel as well during the exercise. So one approach then would be to say, okay, then a meal before, limit the amount of carbohydrate and don't take as much insulin as you normally, or don't take any insulin for it, right?
Because then the exercise could bring it down.
Yes, the exercise can bring it down. I'm not taking a bunch of insulin that is likely then to keep me from completing my exercise. And so that approach of having a lighter meal with not heavy starch or carbs, but don't cover the carbs, or cover the carbs less than you normally would. So for most people's exercise, that'll work better. If it's post-meal, reduce the number of moving parts. Don't take a bunch of insulin and then try and exercise. It's just not gonna work. So that's an alternative approach. Now, I think for most people, what works the best is to try and develop a pattern, figure out what works for you. So if it's before meals, I think it's easier, frankly. And then if I'm on a pump, you could set an exercise mode or go into a temporary basal that's lower. You might find, well, you know, if I don't start above 180, I'm going to get low. So then drink 10 grams of carbohydrate juice beforehand if you know that that's what's going to happen. So for a patient, for this to be productive, they're better off to try and develop a strategy that will work for them. So it fits their schedule, and then again, reduce the number of moving parts. So those are suggestions that can help. With people who are on pumps, they can ahead of time try and decrease their basal insulin, and it really has to be ahead. An hour or two ahead is really better. If they're on basal insulin, they're on multiple daily injections, they can't do that as much, but then they could also feed their muscles. So you're not going to take meal insulin. You're going to ingest some carbohydrate that is quickly absorbed, maybe glucose gel or glucose tablets or fruit juice, to boost their blood glucose before they start the exercise. That might be a strategy that works for them.
Some of the automated insulin delivery systems have something called an activity feature, things like this that might help. So while we're not advocating everyone be on an automated insulin delivery system, we're advocating choice, whatever anybody wants to be on. But you do feel as though if someone is an athlete or really into exercise, you think an automated insulin delivery system would be particularly useful in that situation.
Yes, I do. I agree with that. And the reason is that you've got more control over changing your insulin in the moment or shortly before the moment rather than sort of being stuck with your long-acting insulin that you injected this morning, which you can't take back or change really. Here you have, so okay, well, I want to reduce the amount of insulin that's in active play at the time I'm exercising. So some pumps, you can actually set a higher target with AID. If you know that this is late afternoon, you walk your two big dogs for an hour every day, and that's actually exercise, I could set it so my target is higher at that time with some systems. My system, you couldn't do that, but I could start the exercise mode an hour ahead of time, because then I'm alerting my system, I'm anticipating needing less insulin. So in the future, and it will be less likely to give me extra insulin to try and bring my glucose down. So those are some strategies. All of the automated insulin delivery systems have some way of accommodating exercise. So you want to take advantage of it. And you really have to start it an hour ahead. If you're on multiple daily injections, you can't take your basal back really, but then you can minimize the amount of meal insulin. And you also then can use carbohydrates, hopefully more judiciously. You don't need as much that way. So, for example, an athlete, this is a common pattern where their blood sugar actually goes up during exercise because of the more extreme exercise. Your blood glucose might spike because of epinephrine, norepinephrine. So adrenaline is anti-insulin. And so that spike might raise your blood glucose. So sometimes people actually need a little bit of insulin when they're exercising, not to end up with that extreme high.
So this might be a hard question, but you probably know. So when I was in practice, I couldn't figure out how to, you know, so the stress response, right, happens, and then the person's glucose goes high. So is there any formula, or how is there a way to know how long is that glucose going to be high for? Or, you know, like food, we know approximately, or are we just watching the CGM? I don't know. I was never able to totally figure out how, like, how much insulin should they take when they're stressed? Like, what do you do?
So I don't think there's a formula. I think you need to be judicious, because oftentimes, say if somebody's on 50 units a day, they might only need 1 unit or 1.5 units, maybe halfway through their exercise, to countervail that. So I think trying to think you have to keep it perfectly flat is not realistic. If somebody goes up briefly, and then, you know, briefly meaning, you know, it's less than an hour, and they tend to resolve relatively quickly from that exercise induced. So timing is everything in life, and certainly with insulin. So if somebody's high at the end, now they're done with their exercise, and they say they use their correction factor there, then they're likely to end up overdoing it and be too low, because the second phase that happens with exercise, and for most people, and there's a lot of variables here, it depends on, you know, intensity and duration, but would be that your muscles are trying to recharge their glycogen later. And so there's a delayed decreased need for insulin that might be over hours, even a day. And that's when it's sneaky, you're not thinking about it as much. So if somebody does appear to need some insulin, it should only, a lot of times it's, you know, empiric, but might be just a unit halfway through, but also to be patient, give it an hour or two, let it play out, and don't try and over-treat that. If it's higher than you want it to be, it's probably going to come down on its own relatively quickly. That's the key point.
Yes. And I think a lot of people don't either know or understand, or they just want to be really good control, so they want to get it down, and then I think other, you know, things could happen. So I think at least waiting an hour, and then maybe if it doesn't come down in an hour, then maybe do something.
Right. And that's the beauty of CGM, is there's no mystery, right? So you can find out. You wouldn't have to do 12 finger sticks over the course of the afternoon. You would be able to see. And also, I think for most people, they learn their pattern, right? So routines are, I think, really helpful for people in general, but they're really helpful for people with type 1 diabetes or insulin-requiring diabetes, to learn how you react to different circumstances, learn your pattern, and then allows you to develop adaptive strategies. Like, okay, I have to start, I need some glucose, and I need to take it when I'm driving to the gym, to give it enough time to get in so I can get through a workout and not have it disrupted and not get hypoglycemic.
Right.
For example, that's a common thing.
And of course, we recognize that everyone can't follow a routine, but, you know, whatever percentage of the time they can, that's helpful. But I still think a lot of these strategies will work even if they're not on a perfect routine, you know, quote unquote perfect. Of course, there's no perfect.
Correct.
But, you know, just
but look for patterns. I think that develop the strategy around what you really do or don't do. And nobody's life is going to be exactly the same every day. Also, I think from a diabetes standpoint, for the emotional sort of impact of this, is to give yourself some grace. You don't have to be perfect all the time in order to do well. What you need to do is try and work on strategies that work most of the time.
Yes.
And, you know, the exceptions then are less important because it's most of the time that matters, not every minute of every day. Although, that being said, of course, you should never ignore hypoglycemia. The fire alarm's going off. The problem there is not the alarm, it's the fire, right? So you don't want to ignore hypoglycemia. But hyperglycemia also, you know, sometimes you're going to eat things that, oh, well, it, you know, that didn't work. So I think a productive and emotionally healthy approach to that is to say, all right, I don't have a time machine. That didn't work out so well. What can I learn from this moving forward?
Right.
And that's what patients do with CGM, because it allows them to figure out what works and what doesn't work and what works really well and what's, let's save this for special occasions like birthdays or something, because they can see it in front of them. So I wouldn't overemphasize that every minute has to be perfect. I would try and chip away at the challenges and try and make them better. I think that's the positive approach that emotionally is important. I think as a physician also, or healthcare provider, don't expect perfection. So it's been said that the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. Okay, so let's turn that around. The insanity of type 1 or insulin-requiring diabetes is you can do the same thing over and over again, and you do get a different result. So there is some variation, and I think for people to understand as a provider that nobody's going to have 100% time in range and do everything perfectly every day, what's good enough to keep the patient safe physically and physiologically, but also intact emotionally? This is challenging. There's a lot of mental space that goes into this. The person needs to allow grace to the person in the mirror, the patient with diabetes, and the provider needs to understand, this is challenging. I'm trying to do this and live my life. This is challenging.
Right. You know what I like to think about with diabetes and even without, I don't have diabetes, but in my life,
congratulations.
I try to just remove as many variables as I can. And one thing I try to think about is, I don't know if you remember, but I was a big Steve Jobs fan, and he used to wear the same outfit every day. I don't know if you remember this, right? He wore jeans and a black top. And because he didn't want to occupy his mental space with figuring out what to wear. So same thing, like in diabetes, like if there is something easy you can just remove, like try.
I think that approach, so Steve Jobs wore the same thing every day. So I wouldn't go that far with type 1 diabetes. But what I would say is, you know what? For breakfast, for example, if you have one or two things that you tend to eat for breakfast 80% of the time, nail the 80% that you do regularly day in and day out.
Yes.
That's what's important. It's not the exceptions. So here we are at the American Diabetes Association. I ate a meal that was highly unusual for me last night.
It was really good.
but I may never eat that exact kind of meal again. But I didn't dwell on it. Okay, I don't want to overemphasize that episode. What I should do is think about the 8 or 9 meals that I normally eat every 2 weeks from that menu for dinner. Focus on the things you do regularly, not the things that you do occasionally. Because if you learn more about how you respond to your normal routine, it allows you to reasonably extrapolate adaptive strategy for those exceptional times when I'm eating at a nice restaurant and it's later meal.
If it doesn't work, then okay, it just happened once that week, you know, so less often, which is still particularly important.
What's most important, I think, is to focus on the usual, not the exceptions.
And it also allows you grace. Tell me what your other favorite quote is. What is it? something, not the alternative?
All right, so that's, I think, for diabetes treatment, and actually maybe for life. There's a certain politician that has said, and I think this adapted diabetes technology, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. That's what we should be doing with device decisions, I think, but certainly in diabetes, right? So there's no perfect device, there's no perfect strategy, there's nothing that's going to work all the time. Perfection is not achievable, but improvement is always achievable. And so compared to the alternative, okay, so when I tried this strategy with these meals, it really wasn't working well. How can I make that better? Could I choose different foods? Could I eat those troublesome foods less often? Could I increase the amount of insulin I'm taking? Could I change the order of food? So if I have my starchy stuff at the end of the meal, then my post meals won't go as high. Could I eat less of that food? Could I eat it less often? There's lots of strategies. So you shouldn't compare it to perfection. Compare it to what level can I achieve today? And let's see if I can move today's results, if they're not in a place that's healthy for me and meeting my needs, so that tomorrow's better. Learn from today, improve tomorrow, understand that there's gonna be days that it's just not gonna go your way. But that's where I think things like time and range are important, because it's figuring out what works better. Hopefully you do that more often, and that helps you stay in your target most of the time. And the reality is that people stay in their target most of the time, not all the time, most of the time. As long as they're not getting undue amounts of hypoglycemia, they're going to do well. What we want is people to do better, to feel well day in and day out, so they stay healthy in the long run. And I've also said this about the way I look at diabetes technology now, is that I want to get as many of my patients intact to that day when we're at the American Diabetes Association and they announce we have a cure for type 1 diabetes. I want all my patients, as many of them as possible, to be in line and able to take advantage of that. And my job now is to get as many people, myself and all of my colleagues in this space, to get as many of the club with diabetes to the finish line intact, healthy, emotionally and physically, that they can take advantage of that. Let's get as many people there as we can. And that means working today with the knowledge that things will be better tomorrow, but we have to get them there.
Okay, so I think we just have a few more questions. Let's talk about remote monitoring and how do you approach like sharing data and communication and things like that, CGM data sharing.
Well, remote CGM data, I think, is really powerful. So just, you know, to say what it is, it does require a smartphone. So your CGM data goes to the smartphone. The person who has the diabetes has set up or decided or worked out others that can see that data. Now, they might see 100% of the data, or they might only get alerted if you're in trouble. I actually prefer the latter approach, because I think what you need is a backup, at least for adults. You need a backup for hypoglycemia or severe problems, not somebody nagging you and sort of wondering what you ate for lunch because you went up a little bit above your goal. So remote monitoring for children is invaluable. Parents can see from across the country or across town or the next room how their children are doing, so they want it in real time. That's really important for seniors as well, as they're getting older and maybe they're becoming forgetful and they're more challenged, maybe they live alone, that adult children can follow their parents and provide them safety. They provide them a safety net so that if they're getting low and they're not responding, that they could call. If they don't answer, you can call 911, or you could call a next door neighbor who could come over and intervene. So sharing is a critical safety net. I think it's also, if it's done positively, can be emotionally helpful too, because, you know, get an attaboy. You did really well today. You know, you did great. Congratulations. Right. I mean, so that's that has to be some messaging, not just, oh, Lordy, what did you eat?
Right. I think it's a particular, it has to be a conversation between the person and...
And you also have to have a strategy. So if somebody gets low,
right,
what is the follower supposed to do? Have an action plan, right?
Yep.
So if you're low and you're in a hotel, I'm, you know, in the Hyatt in San Diego, and my wife gets a message that, you know, my glucose is 45 and I don't seem to be doing anything about it. What is she supposed to do with that? So she would call the hotel and say, you know, my husband has diabetes. This is not normal for him. Nicholas Argento, can you please check him, right? So this could be life-saving, and it has been, not for me, but I mean for others. So I think that sharing emotionally, it's helpful to, you know, if it's done in a positive way, but as a safety net, it's huge.
So I know how much you love CGM, Dexcom in particular. Are there any features that you really would love that we don't have? Not Dexcom, like that don't currently exist right now, either on a pump or a CGM. Is there anything like you really want now?
No, I actually think what we have now is immensely powerful and immensely helpful. Things can always improve. I think, you know, lengthening the time that the sensor stays in place would be one option. But I think actually the next level that I think would be really helpful, not so much for me, but for the average patient, would be some decision guidance, some patient assistance where, you know, for 3 days, say that your post meals tend to be pretty high, you're out of range for a couple of hours, that you'd get an alert. You're running high after lunch the last 3 days.
Maybe
you should consider changing, you know, or speak to your physician, change your carbohydrate ratio or
like
eating less carbohydrate.
Decision
support,
right?
Decision support is where I think the next level, not for the Uber patients that are already doing well and, you know, are online and really engage in this, but for the average person, decision support is the next level where I think would, but it can't be so based on
like
weeks and weeks.
It's
got to be close enough to an event that a couple of days maybe would be it, and that people can opt in or opt out.
Yes.
That's key, because I might not want that, right?
Right. And it has to be easy enough to shut on or off, because maybe you want it one time and then maybe you don't want it the next few days or something.
Right. Right. Or you're drifting low, or you've been low 3 times in the last week between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m.
Right.
Are you exercising?
So even though CGM does give a person that information, it might just be an easier way to point it out or point out some things they might not see.
Well, there's no decision support with it. And this might say some things that might cause nighttime hypoglycemia, daytime exercise, alcoholic beverages in the evening. People may not realize that.
Well, what
over-treatment,
would we do about that?
Over-treatment of snacks before going to bed, level of basal insulin too high.
Right.
I mean, these, you know, there's some...
So give options.
Some things to consider, you know, and then speak to your
health,
you know. But if you provide people sort of a menu of possibilities, it might be things, particularly alcohol is one that people aren't aware of, that alcohol actually does cause a tendency toward hypoglycemia that's delayed and is maybe inapparent. So
yeah. Okay, perfect. I think those are really useful and helpful, and hopefully they are on the horizon, the near horizon. So finally, is there any last piece of advice you want to tell our listeners? Anything about living with CGM or living with diabetes or anything you want to share with our listeners?
So I've said some of the key tips, but for healthcare providers, understand CGM is a game changer. It's critically important. You're empowering people to figure out what works. Nobody chooses to be unwell, and give people a tool that will help them figure out strategies with you to stay well, to get better, or to stay healthy, avoid problems. That's a win-win-win for situations. For people who walk around with diabetes, they need to understand that this is challenging and it is work, but it works. It's work, but it works. So you can do this. You don't have to be perfect, but you should try and develop strategies. Work toward better, not toward nirvana.
Yeah. And you know what else I think we should mention? If someone hasn't considered either an automated delivery system or a CGM, or they just either are afraid or didn't think about it, or for whatever reason, maybe just even trying it, right? And then if they decide they don't like it, that's okay too, but maybe being open-minded to try things if they're not already on it.
Well, I think that's actually really critically important. I've had this experience many times where I've had a patient who I thought would benefit from this, and they were reluctant, and they kept saying, well, you know, I don't know, and they, you know, sort of maybe erect barriers. But I can't tell you how often this has happened, where somebody starts using it, and the comment when they come back the next time is like, oh, geez, I don't know why I waited so long. This is game changing. This is life changing. I mean, I just can't, some version of that so many times. So particularly if you tried a different CGM that wasn't user-friendly, or it could have been a Dexcom from 10 years ago, it could have been another company's CGM, that they continue to improve. They are more and more and more user-friendly, more and more accurate, more and more useful. Try again, right? And if one doesn't meet your needs, try a different one, because we have lots of choices. But this is a powerful tool. It's been 101 years since the first human being was injected with insulin. That was 1922. And it's been, you know, approximately 45 years since finger sticks became available. Insulin pumps the same, about 45 years. CGM has been since 2006. It's continued to improve. And the first AID system was 10 years ago. So we keep moving forward. Don't base your current decision-making on some experience from 8 or 10 years ago any more than you would make a decision about what computer to buy now based on your experience, you know, 30 years ago or 20 years ago.
I know. Remember the first Mac? It was terrible.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
right.
There's been progress made, right?
Yeah.
And find what's right for you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Argento. I think this information is going to help a lot of people, both healthcare professionals and patients. And it was great having you. And to our listeners, please tune in next time. We're going to talk about some clinical evidence. We might talk about early initiation of CGM. We're going to talk about a Dexcom-sponsored study that helps show some outcomes. And for more information about Dexcom, please go to Dexcom.com. And we'll see you next time on another episode of Real Time, Real Talk.